I drove a few people back to my place after, and then the guy who was serving up there was a friend of mine, and they all went on into town, and he said, "I'll leave you a little bit of coke left, Paul." I went, "No, I'm all right, I don't want it." Like, I desperately didn't want it. I said, "Please don't leave it." He went, no, it's all right, I'll leave it on the side." I went, "Please don't leave it." He went, no, you drove, you're all right. And done the lot.
You know why he left it for you?
Tell me.
He left it for you because there is something about a person that uses, listen, not just coke, think about someone who smokes. If you've stopped smoking, right, and you go to the, I like to use the pub scenario. If you've stopped smoking, you go to the pub, there will be people around you who say, "Do you want to come out for a fag?" "No, I don't smoke anymore." "It's Friday, just have one." "Yeah, I'll give you one, have one." Because somewhere along the line, it makes them feel better. They don't feel so bad about themselves if you still do it as well. So if then you do a line, it's like, "Oh yeah, I don't feel bad, he's done a line. He couldn't stop anyway." Yeah, I see him do it. Like, he couldn't stop. He tried, he couldn't stop. No. Then you don't try again, because then you will remain with them, right?
I'm Paul Scolfort, and this is Powerful. In this series, I come clean about my own sobriety and the journey it took for me to get here. In each episode, I will speak to a special guest about their addictions and how they achieve sobriety and how they maintain a happy lifestyle today. Today, I'm really excited to talk to Elliot Wald. With over 29 years of professional experience, Elliot has helped over 100,000 people to overcome addictions. Elliot Wald is an accomplished author of 3 books. He's helped relieve patients of ailments, fears, anxieties, and phobias. So in some of these episodes, there will be discussions of alcohol misuse, drugs, sexual abuse, suicide, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Hey, Elliot, welcome to the podcast.
How you doing, Paul?
I'm good, mate. Thank you for coming.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Good to be here.
So you're an expert in NLP, psychotherapy, hypnotherapy, and you help a lot of people with addictions, phobias, and lots of things. But I'd like to know a little about you first, please, Elliot.
That's okay.
Where was you brought up, mate? And how was your upbringing?
So my upbringing was very challenging, let's put it that way. So 6 years old, my dad's killed. My mum takes me to a boarding school in Kent to take an entrance exam for high achievers. I pass the entrance exam, and within a very short space of time, here I am at boarding school. So I'm at this boarding school shortly after my father's been killed. I guess you can imagine that's quite...
It's unimaginably
upsetting.
Tragic, yeah.
It's a hothouse. In other words, the children in this boarding school are educated from school starts at 7 o'clock in the morning at the school chapel every morning for prayers. 8 o'clock lessons would start. There'd be a break at 9 o'clock for breakfast, and then the school would continue on until 6 o'clock in the evening lessons. At 6 years old, you can imagine that's quite intense. And you're talking about reading Latin and all other subjects, you know, Greek mythology, like, where would you ever use this? But this is the way it worked. And then in the evening, you would be in this huge area where you would eat, and the teacher would go around while you're doing your homework, and you'd be there till like 8 o'clock at night, 9 o'clock at night, and then bed. And that's the way it was for years. And during that period of time, I didn't see my mum.
How long was that period?
3 years.
Right.
And more or less, I return home, and there is my mum, and my mum has a new husband, and this man who in my head I called the pig, and I would say out loud.
Yeah.
And let's just say that the pig was a abusive, mentally torturing, violent individual who would cane me, who would abuse me, who would do all sorts of things to rip the life out of my soul and the very being as a 9-year-old child by this point. This went on and on, but my mum did nothing about it until my brothers were born when I was 11. They're twins. And that went on for a further 3 years until I was 14 and I ran away from home.
What was your mindset then? Because I shared with you before that my dad had a pretty horrendous upbringing, was taken away as well. In fact, he was the only one who said that on the bus leaving Canning Town, he was waving and smiling because he just wanted to get away.
Yeah, don't blame him.
But how do you deal with that at the time? What was?
I think for me at the time, I mean, I can't say how I dealt with it at 6 to 9, but I think I was a very her boy. I think certainly on later on, so like when I left home at 14, from let's say 14, probably through to 23-ish, 24-ish, 25-ish, somewhere around there. I think I was a very, very aggressive, very, had a massive chip on my shoulder, big attitude. I wasn't a bully, but I would say that I would somehow be there in the middle of all the problems if it ever kicked off with my friends or some other people. Somehow I always gravitated to try and find trouble.
Do you think that was protecting your friends, or was that sort of just saying, I'm not having this anymore?
I think on one level, maybe it was protecting them, but you know, I'm not sure I can give myself the credit for that. I think more of it was, I was just angry with the world. I was just angry, just so angry. And everything was out of proportion. You know, a car would cut me up, and whereas somebody else might give them the finger, you know, I'd be jumping out of the car trying to drag them through the window. You know, I was looking to vent my emotions, my anger, my upset, my frustrations on whomever.
Did you have any allies at that point that you could talk to confidently?
I think for me, it's interesting because I found my way into a gym at 15 years old. And just to put this into perspective for people listening, I'm 54 years old. And what that actually meant was to go to a gym, and I'm talking about a proper hardcore gym back in the day, was not like it is today where there are gyms on virtually every street corner and it's a very common thing. And, you know, the youth of today, male and female, it's very normal for them to go to the gym. It's part of the normality. But back in the day, this was not. It took me an hour to get a bus to the gym and then an hour back. So it's a 2-hour trek just before you even train. And somehow I gravitated to this hardcore gym. I never forget. It said, a winner never quits and a quitter never wins around the top of the gym. And this
That's
huge
a
writing.
Brilliant logo, isn't it?
A winner never quits and a quitter never wins. I think that became almost embedded into my mindset for all the years I trained at this gym. And when you ask about, did I have any allies? I think where I was a 15-year-old, 16-year-old, 17-year-old boy in a man's gym who was angry, who was strong. You know, by the time I'm 15, 16 stone at 16, 17 stone at 17, 18 stone at 18, 19 stone at 19 stone, at 19 years old, sorry. And I think that I got a lot of respect in the gym I was in. And therefore, these people who were much older than me, I looked up to. And I don't think I shared what went on in my life at that time because I don't think that I wanted to do that. But they were certainly there for me in one aspect or another.
When I was 15, I used to go to, there's a guy, I'm still friends with him. I don't see him much because I lived away for years. His name's Phil Dolby. And he had a famous picture on the front of the Sun with 22-inch arms with a Union Jack on it. And we used to go to his gym. We used to give him a pound, and it was basically in the back of his house. It was beautiful, amazing equipment, but it was a rough gym. And I started there probably around 15 as well. And I loved it because it was all the older boys.
Yeah, exactly.
And big, like, tough guys, really nice, always up to stuff. And I was boxing at the time. And a couple of them come to see me fight and realised I could fight and basically earned their respect and spent 3 years in that gym, 3 days a week. Loved it.
That's the thing about it, Paul. I think in those hardcore gyms, there is something about respect. You earn your respect and you understand what respect is. And for me, that translates into other areas of my life. And those are the values that I have taken through my entire life, you know, and I think it taught me an awful lot.
It was nice for me as well because there was a couple of times where I always said I never got picked on. I did. There was a little firm of fellas around the corner and these guys were, they looked out for me and they was good. And I you know, respect them for that. It was like just camaraderie, innit? Just belonging.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, which is important.
Like a brotherhood.
Yeah, literally, yeah. Really nice. And also when they was doing naughty things, they'd be like, I'd be like, can I come? They're like, no. Don't get involved.
I grew up around a lot of naughty people, but they've always been the salt of the earth to me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So where did you go with the bodybuilding?
So the progression from growing up in this abusive household that I ran away from, for me, I found a family in the gym. You know, when I say a brotherhood, I really mean a brotherhood, you know. And these people were there for me. And it was just something that I gravitated towards. Like, to give you an idea, I mean, I don't know anybody knows about bodybuilders, but back in the day, there was a pro bodybuilder called Albert Beckles. He was in his late 50s. And, you know, there I was, a 16, 17-year-old kid, and he'd come over from living in America, and he also lived in Barbados. He'd come over to South Harrow to Dave's gym where I'd train as a kid. He'd take me under his wing. There were other people there who were British bodybuilding champions who took me under their wing. And I trained. I trained like a fucking animal. I trained hard because I had so much anger in me. And, you know, as I said, there, you know, I was squatting like, you know, people are going to run me down. Yeah, that guy never did that. I actually got some videos of it though. I was like squatting like 300 kilos back in the day.
Yeah, that's a lot.
You know, that's a lot of weight competing at, you know, powerlifting events.
Yeah.
And therefore I had a natural strength, a natural anger, a natural propensity to put muscle on. And I was focused. That's all I wanted to do. Like, I get up in the morning, I eat my eggs, I do my porridge, I train. It was like, you know, I'd eat, I train. I did nothing else but eat and train. And like 3 o'clock in the morning, I'd be up drinking a protein drink and going back to sleep. And I was competing Northeast, Southeast, British championships, all over.
Yeah.
And it was just where I was in my life at that time. And I love it. I still love it today. I still go to the gym. I don't train the same way. I don't train to put on size. Look at me. I'm 13 stone. I was 19 stone. I've been there, bought the t-shirt, done it.
I understand.
But now I have the fun of going with my son on a weekend. You know, it's a different, yeah. It's a different dynamic. I still love it.
There's something really amazing for guys about training. And I think that for me, obviously we're going to go on to addiction, that I competed as a boxer from 15 to, I think, around 19. Went for the British title a couple of times, and I loved that too. I absolutely loved that, being part of a crew. You're on your own, so you've got to do your own thing. But being part of that crew, it just took me away from why would I want to party and why would I want to do anything, you know, at that time.
You know, it's funny, you said this just now. You just said, you're part of a team, but you're on your own. And it's funny because I'm clearing out my loft at the moment, and I came across a folder, and there's some photos of me competing, and there's a newspaper article from when I was 25 years old. And it says something like 17 and a half stone bodybuilder attempts British championships, right? And anyway, there's this article. It's only one page, a little bit of a whole page, maybe a quarter of a page it is. And in the bottom, it says something like, I must have said to the reporter at the time, it said, I used to play a lot of rugby. I don't really like playing rugby because when we lose, it's all down to the team. I like to do a sport where it's all down to me. At least if I lose, it's my fault. And my son read that and he went, Dad, you haven't changed one bit.
But there's something in that. There's something stoic about that.
Yeah, I guess. I like to know that if I didn't succeed, it's on me.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't pull up. I didn't push enough. I didn't press enough. I didn't do enough. That's down to me. I don't like it that we didn't succeed because somebody else didn't do enough.
I totally understand that.
That's how it is for me.
Yeah, I totally understand that. When I was a kid, I was really, well, I guess I was really soft. And my dad did lots of things to try and toughen me up. And I hated him for it for a long time. I had a lot of resentment for my dad. And now I love him. We've got a good friendship. You know, he's 84. And I understand some of his values and what he was trying to do. Now I've got young kids.
Would you repeat some of the things he did?
No.
No?
No, what I would repeat, what by example, he showed me a lot by example. So if I was ever in trouble, he'd be the first person there. If I needed anything physical or practical, he'd be the first person there. But there was a lot of times, like he told me I wasn't allowed to have a motorcycle. So I bought one at 14, used to race it around, sprayed it in camouflage, hit it over the field so I wouldn't get caught. And one day I crashed it really badly and I took all the skin off from my ankle all the way up to my side and I was in shock. And someone went over to get my dad and he come down and he just looked at me and he's like, he never used to swear my dad, funny enough. He said, get yourself up, get on that bike, take it home and show yourself down. And that was it. And that was literally it. And I used to think, how mean is that? But I kind of understand that it was probably when my kids do something, I feel like they're paying because I don't want them to get hurt. So I kind of changing my view on it now, you know?
I get that. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, listening to you talk about your dad and when you asked me the question about how I grew up and what I went through, I don't really ponder on that. I don't focus on that at all anymore. Mm. What I do focus on is this. Everything I didn't get, I want in my life. I didn't have the family. I didn't have the relationship. I didn't have the love. I didn't have the commitment. That's what I want. You know, the way I am with my son, the bond and the things that I do, they're all things I never had an opportunity to do that I absolutely love.
Yeah.
And for me, it's about, out of all the wrongs, trying to do some rights.
Yeah, and there's two ways you can go. I know some other friends of mine have had a bad time that have gone the complete other way, in jail or dead already. I'm sure you do as well. And it's kind of, that's the thing. When I look at my dad, my granddad gambled all the houses away and loads of stuff and whatever. But my dad always had a house, paid for, food on the table, just did all the good basic stuff that probably he never had. You know, so as I'm talking to you, I'm warming up more to my dad every minute.
You know, it's like a bird rests on a branch. How does it know that the branch can take its wings, its weight? Only by believing in its wings that it has the ability to fly off, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, as you think about your dad and that he's that ability to fly off and have that wing and that belief in himself, and you're taking that belief within yourself for him.
Yeah. I love what you said about what you do with your kids, because that's what I do. I didn't have a great education, so that's what I provide for my kids, and travel all the time. We try and have experiences all the time, because the first time I went abroad was I was 15.
You know, it's funny you should say traveling. I was scrolling through Facebook at like 5:30 this morning, and there was something about, I'm being fined by the council. I don't know who posted it. I'm being fined by the council for taking my kids out of school during summer holidays, or not during summer holidays, during term time and not summer holidays, right? And when you say going away, it's funny because over the years, I've had many opportunities in my industry, in the world of hypnosis and psychology and being on TV and writing books and all those other things, that I had a contract. I was in Australia doing a lot of seminars, and I had an opportunity to take my children with me for that period of time. And that year, we went to Thailand multiple times on the way to Australia, Singapore. And when I got back, I actually got called into the school, and I think it was something like 3 months over and above the school holidays that my kids were out of school. And I was told that if you continue in this way, that your kids couldn't continue on this school. And I look back when you talk about this, and I think to myself, but hang on, what were all the other things they learned? They learned different cultures. They learn different experiences. And when you give them money, and you give them to a money in a different, you know, a different denomination, different currency, and they have to work out to go and buy something in a shop, how that is, they're using maths, they're using English, they're using social skills.
Yeah.
And I think that's what it's all about.
Which is 80% of communication. Totally, there's life. I used to fly 150 times a year straight for 8 years. And that's when when I was modeling, I used to have to carry bags of francs and Deutschmark stuff. It was a pain. But to learn to live on my own was amazing, and to see all these things. So you've helped, I've watched loads of stuff on YouTube with your TV things and what they put you through trying to help someone with a mug phobia.
ITV This Morning Show.
Yeah, that was awful. I love the way they was leveraging it against you. Like, oh, how do you feel now about the mud? It looks really bad. I was like, I watched them, you know, and I fell for it.
Did you watch the one with the needles, the phobia needles?
Yeah, I mean, that was
listen
silly.
Listen to this. I'll tell you the backstory behind this. So first of all, the idea was to appear on ITV This Morning Show every single day with a different phobia presented to me, which I didn't know what the phobia was before I even arrived in the studio. So you arrive in the studio at like 6:30 in the morning, and the producers talk to you and they go, right, we've got somebody backstage and they have a fear of soup, tomorrow soup. And you're like, okay. And then you have like half an hour to talk to them and maybe an hour to do therapy with them. And then bang, they're presented with the stimuli. There's the tomato soup. Now, what do you think of it? And they're eating it. I've got that one out. And here's the interesting thing. The TV do not care whether I'm successful or not successful, because at the end of the day, they get great entertainment. So they have ticked their box, right? Yeah. It is my neck on the line every single day that I did that. Nobody's ever done that live every single day. Lots of people don't edited stuff, but never live, right? And the one about the needles, this was interesting. Her lady on there, she had a phobia of needles. So I go back in the room. I use some modern psychology, some hypnosis. She comes out. Dr. Chris Steele, he was the doctor, resident doctor for This Morning, ITV This Morning Show at the time. And I don't know whether he doesn't like hypnosis or he doesn't like people being changed very rapidly in front of his own eyes. But so the idea was then to present a needle and a syringe to her. And he pulls out, you can go and watch this, it's on my YouTube channel. He pulls out a syringe. I don't know what the fuck that's for, a horse. He pulls out a syringe this big, right?
Yeah.
And he goes, well, let's see if you've got a favorite needle. And on the end of it is a needle like this, right? I don't know what you do that. And she just smiles. So he's now thinking, oh, okay, this isn't good enough. And he turns around and goes, didn't you think you wanted to get your ears pierced? Now, I had never done anything to do with their ears, right? It'd been to do with the syringing. It's a different thing going on. Let's get your ears pierced backstage. And I went online, live on the air. I went, hang on a minute. If you want to get your ears pierced, I need another 30 minutes with this lady. Like, really cool. So they're like, okay. So it's 30 minutes, took her backstage. They pierced her ears live on stage. And I was like, there you go, Dr. Chris Steele.
Yeah, mic drop moment.
Exactly.
It's terrible where they put you in there just for the drama.
That's
and the
all
insane,
they want.
Right?
Because at the end of the day, listen, I get it. That's what you sign up for. At the end of the day, if you don't believe in your capabilities, don't go and do live TV. That's
yeah.
it.
Yeah, which you is know. A lot.
Yeah.
How did you get interested in the mind?
I think if this is going to sound so...
Hit me with it.
Is it a calling? Is it a empathy to... I have this gift from everything that I went through that was wrong. The gift that I got given was to have an empathy, to be able to understand people, to be able to see where they are and be able to try and see with them a way out. Yeah. And so I look at that as a gift.
I think that is a gift. Why did you move to cocaine and helping a lot of people with addiction? And is that, with addiction, it goes across all boards, doesn't it? From food, alcohol, drugs, shopping, gambling. What's the most addiction that you come across?
So what's the most clients I see somebody for? Yeah. That's without question, that's cocaine addiction. And that is because that is my specialist subject and area. So if I take you through a history of this, so back in the day when I first started, 29, it was 30 years this November, 30 years ago. Initially, I was doing phobias and like I was the guy, like, come and see me. Within an hour, I'll fix your phobia. It doesn't matter what it is. And that was my reputation. And that's why TV got wind of me and I was on BBC and ITV and This Morning shows and lots of other TV shows doing the same thing. And that was fine. But along this journey, I myself had found cocaine. And let's be honest, when you're young and you first do it and you go out and you suddenly feel like Superman, and it works, and you have a good time, but you're young, and you can get less sleep, and it not affect you as much, and you be up the next day and off doing things, and it's not for years later. So what started off for me as a sociable thing, like friends of mine who worked in the gym would work on the door, and they'd be like, just get me into a club, and I don't think I've ever queued to get in a club anywhere in my life, just because I was the young kid in the gym with all these bigger, stronger, older men that looked after me, if you like, for want of a better word.
How did it come into your... I can remember the first time I saw coke, and I can remember the first time I took it. It was very specific circumstances. How did it come to you?
Do you know what? When you say that, I remember a situation. So let's go back into the bonnet. So when I'm 20 years old, I have this bee in my bonnet that I've just competed at the British Championships in England, and I want to be the best bodybuilder in the world. So what am I going to do? I know. America is calling, right? Because you know, in Los Angeles back in the day, there was Gold's Gym and there was World Gym, and
trained
it was
a couple of times on a beach.
Perfect. Yeah. And then you've got, as I say, you've got on the beach, Venice Beach, and that was the mecca of bodybuilding. So all I knew was, I'm one of the best bodybuilders in England for my age at that time, 20 years old. I want to be in California. So I had $1,000 in my pocket. I didn't know a single person.
What year was this?
I'm 20 years old, so I don't know what year that is. I was born in 89,
yeah.
89, right? So 1989, I have $1,000 in my pocket, and I decided to get on a plane to Los Angeles. Get out.
On your own?
On my own. All I know is I want to train, right? I'm a bodybuilder. I want to train. I want to be the best in the world. And so here I am in LA. I don't know a single person. I've got $1,000 in my pocket. So I get out LAX airport. I went, take me to Gold's Gym. Because that's the only thing I know about. That's the only thing I know about California. It's Gold's Gym, right? Take me to Gold's Gym. So he drops me off in Santa Monica near Gold's Gym. And there I am with this like one rucksack thing. Like going and train. I have a wicked workout. I'm like, I'm here. I've made it. I've done it. I made it, right? The next day, I'm walking down Santa Monica Boulevard. I swear to God, I'm in a pair of shorts. Like, I got a six pack. I'm looking in wicked shape, right? Remember, I'm like way up there at my age. Yeah. And there must be a dozen people walk past me whose physiques were 20 times better than me. They were just the norm. And I just was like, whoa, okay.
It's a different game over there.
It's a different game. So Yeah, so there I was in America, wanting to be a bodybuilder. And I knew Jermaine Jackson, Michael Jackson's brother. I'm walking down Beverly Hills, the Rolls Royce Corniche pulls up, and the window's down, and Jermaine Jackson calls out. So I just look at him, he's like, what are you doing here? I'm like, I know him from Gold's Gym, because there was a Gold's Gym in London that I trained at in Tottenham back in the day. I was going to ask you that,
gotcha.
He was part owner of that gym that I worked in. So at the time, I was into training in a big way, and I started working as a personal trainer and made money and ended up staying there for like 2 years, 2.5 years. And during that period of time, I went to a party in Bel Air.
Because usually a good party in Bel Air.
Along my journey of training people, because people come up to me, they're like, oh, you're English. Say something. I'm like, hello. And they're like, you're English, right? So I had all these people wanting me to train them because I'm a 21-year-old man by this time, or 20-year-old boy, with a great physique, who's English, who all these people in Hollywood want me to train, right? So now I'm training all these people and I start getting invited to parties, right? So I get invited to a party, and on the table at one of these parties is a bowl. Looking back now, I realize that bowl is cocaine. But even then at 21, I hadn't touched a drug. So I never touched it.
Did you know anything about it at all?
Look, I don't even think I did, to be honest with you. I don't know, but I don't think I did know what it was, right? I must have been about 24, 25 years old. And I started taking it as a social thing my friends gave me. And then like the journey, it's typical journey, as I talk about with all my patients, it's like you start off and it's a Friday night. And you know, every Friday night, and then you create this trigger in your brain. It's like Friday night, I'm going to use. Every Friday, I'm going to use. And then what happens is it's a Saturday. So maybe you use it on a Friday and a Saturday. And maybe alcohol is your trigger, your gateway. Maybe you go to the pub and you have a few pints, or if you're a lady, you have a few glasses of wine and you get on it. And then you end up doing that for years upon years upon years. And then maybe it's a Wednesday. I can only talk about my journey, right? But maybe it's a Wednesday. And then on a Wednesday, you have some bad news and you end up calling on. And before you know it, you don't realize, but years have gone by. And all of a sudden you look back and you suddenly realize that I didn't intend to end up doing this every weekend or 3 days a week or 5 days a week or 7 days a week or those people who don't use it for a month but then do a four-day bender. Nobody sees it coming, right? So for me, I didn't see it coming. And here I am in the world of psychology. Here I am as a psychologist using hypnosis, using neuro-linguistic programming, using gestalt therapy, using all these different modern psychologies. And yet here I am, the one with the addiction.
When did you start all the psychologies, Elliot? So was you doing
I was already practicing. Okay. I was already working. I was already doing. So I was already seeing patients. But I was not seeing patients for cocaine. Not that it makes a difference, right? I was seeing patients for phobias and anxiety. And then I was on a BBC documentary with Professor Kathy Sykes, where I took somebody. Oh, that's right. It was on BBC. That's also on my YouTube. I had a woman who had, I did this quite a lot. A woman had a compulsion to chocolate. And live on air, I stopped eating chocolate by taking a compulsion and a repulsion. So in other words, someone your compulsion, something you can't not do, and a repulsion. I think in this lady, if I remember back, it was like cabbages or prawns. Like she found that reaction. And what I did is I took the compulsion and the repulsion.
Is that called swish?
Yeah, it's kind of like a swish technique or something like that. Yeah, but what mine's is far more advanced than that.
Of course it is.
And what I did is I then created that in her mind so that she could not eat the chocolate. And then I wanted an added little touch on TV because you wanted to make it look good. I then added that every time she ate chocolate, it felt like a hair getting stuck in the back of her throat. And I was doing this on TV. And no, she started doing it. And actually they cut it because she threw up. But what you do see on the TV show and what you see on the YouTube thing is offering the chocolate and the crisps. And she's going, no. Low like that.
And does that, for people who don't know NLP and psychology and all this stuff, is that permanent now?
So let's answer that question because I don't want to send people in the wrong direction. So firstly, let's just cover NLP so that I can answer that question. In the United Kingdom, there is no legislation to control NLP, which stands for neuro-linguistic programming, right? Basically created in the 1970s by Dr. Richard Bandler and Dr. John Grinder. To incredibly intelligent psychologists who were into maths and language and linguistics that studied other people, who they then coined this term neuro-linguistic program. They wrote lots and lots of books together. I don't even know how many books. And then they kind of fell out, right? And then what happened is they started teaching their NLP, what they called it. And this went on for years and years and years. And they taught people practitioner and master and trainer and trainer's trainer. And then what happened is people thought, I know, I can teach this. And I'll call it NLP and I'll teach this. So the people they taught started teaching it. And then the people that they taught started teaching it. And the people that they taught started teaching it. And now there is a proliferation of over 2,000 places in the United Kingdom. And in my opinion, there's probably no more than 5 of them that are even worth opening. So now you get people who have trained at these places that are absolutely useless, who then think that what they have is great knowledge, and then go out in the public domain and try and help people, but actually create more problems. And I see this a lot in my therapy, because people, I went to see this guy and he was helping me for cocaine, or I went to see this guy and they had anxiety and I'm worse. And I'm like, yeah, because this guy has no experience.
I have a story about that.
Go on.
So I, because I'm really, it really fascinates me. I've always been interested in the mind and stuff and the work I've done on myself and how I've kind of reprogrammed myself correlates to a lot of this. But there was one point I was really desperate. And I just didn't want to use cocaine anymore. And I'd been through the, I've told everyone, I'm not doing it, whatever I say, don't give it to me. And I'd stay at a friend's house and I'd put it under his door. And then 10 minutes later, I'd be knocking on the door, can I have a little bit? And they'd be like, no, dude, you said no. I said, yeah, but that was then. And I would manipulate him to get it back, right? And it's just powerless against this drug.
Are you tired of waking up with a hangover?
Or just of generally feeling anxious, with limited memory and a suspicious itchy feeling in your crotch?
Yep, we are too. I'm Vic.
And I'm Hamish.
And until recently, we were your average binge drinkers. Until we gave up and started the Sober Awkward podcast.
In it, we take a deep look at every aspect of sobriety. The funny, the weird and the plain awkward.
So join us every week as we say cheers to a more authentic, confident, sober version of ourselves. Did that sound a bit cheesy, Haim?
Yeah, you sound like a total twat, but they were going to find that out soon enough anyway.
Yeah. Listen to Sober Awkward wherever you get your podcasts.
So I saw probably one of the guys you're talking about. I just went through the Yellow Pages, I think, at the time. Phoned up a guy who was in the local neighbourhood and just said, Can you help with cocaine addiction? He was a really nice man, but I think he's probably been doing it a year and he was retired and it's, you know, that kind of thing. And he said, well, I've never done that before. He said, but I'm sure we can do it. So he put me under, we've done the thing. And I can't remember exactly, but it would be, if I saw the drug, it would bring a bad picture up, which would put me off the drug, right?
Mm.
So what I did... When I left his house, I actually had tears in my eyes. I thought, I am cured. I am fucking cured. The phone rings. A friend says, I'm going to Brown's tonight. Would you like to come? And I went, actually, I would. He said, are you sound up? But I was like, yeah. He said, shall I get something? I went, don't do it anymore. I said, I'm totally cured. And he laughed. He went, yeah, whatever, Paul. I went, no, honestly, I am. Got to the club, had a laugh. He said, should we go? Do you want to come and do a line in the toilet? I went, no. I said, but I want to see if this works. So we go in the toilet. He puts the line down. I did see this image, but I shut my eyes, went underneath and done the thing, carried on for another 6 years.
Going back to something you said before, you said, you know, how did I get into cocaine addiction? And that's the, you know, what do I deal with the most? And my answer was cocaine addiction. So what happened was I was doing it on the TV, and while I'm on TV, I start to realize that, you know, I look like I'm using. Maybe nobody else could use it, but I did. So what did I do? I downloaded every single thesis paper on addiction, on cocaine specifically addiction. I wrote every single book on cocaine addiction that was in English. And I read every thesis paper. So remember, I've already got to this point, years and years of studying, because I'm a great believer in what's called CPD, which is continual professional development. So for me, I don't sit here and go, listen, I studied my course 30 years ago, but you know what? I had another course 25 years ago, then 20 years ago, then 15 years ago, then 10 years ago, then 5 years ago. You know, I continually upgrade my skills, my mind, on all the different types of psychology out there, because I want to be able to provide the very best for my client. Mm. Because at the end of the day, I want to get from where they are to where they want to be as fast as humanly possible. So when I was on the ITV This Morning show and using, I decided that I needed to get out of this. So I got out of my contract and I applied the things that I know of myself, and I stopped using. And that was really my journey into deciding that I wanted to not just deal with phobias and anxiety, which I still do to some degree, because you can't see every single day, every single patient for cocaine addiction, because I would lose my sanity, right?
I'm quite sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like, sure. You imagine seeing 8 to 10 people 5 days a week, week in, week out, year in, year out. Like, you know, you need to sit somewhere.
That would zap, that would vaporize your energy.
Exactly.
Yeah, for sure.
So, so I stopped myself, then I began to help other people stop. And I started with my friends, and they stopped. And then I have all different types of friends, and I don't judge people. I've got friends of mine that used to be dealers, and I would help them to stop using so they didn't use their own supply.
Yeah, which is common.
Yeah. And then I had other friends, and they all stopped using, and then other people stopped coming to me, and I started helping them. And it just kind of, you know, snowballed, if you like. It just got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, that just shows you the level of people across the world who are using cocaine, that it's become the norm.
It's huge now. It's huge.
I guarantee if we left here now, Paul, and we went down, because we're in the city, right, and we go to one pub, you and I will be able to go, oh, look, there's someone serving up.
Yeah.
It's just the norm, right?
Yeah, completely. And it's, I mean, I haven't used for 20 years, so it's probably completely shite right now. But I'm really interested in the results you get. And what you specifically do, you don't have to say, but what you specifically do for, like, to get someone off it. Because if you're, so the same thing happened to me. I tried it really to belong, is what happened. And
absolutely.
I thought, no, you know, it was all right. It wasn't bad. Someone had already put something else in my drink.
You know something? Can I just cut you off? You said I tried it to belong. I'm going to call it, I call that the tribe. You wanted to be in the tribe, right? Yeah. You wanted to be in the tribe, and therefore you had to have a tribe mentality, which means you had to do everything that the tribe does. Now, the tribe, because all tribes have their own places where they go to, right? So their own lodges or their own tents or their own, whatever it is, every tribe has a place where they congregate. So your tribe congregated in a specific place. Was it a pub?
That was actually a house at the time.
Okay, a house.
But yeah.
So your tribe congregated at the tribe's house. And when you go to the tribe's house, there is an expectation of what is going to happen. And that's where you're at, because you want to please the tribe, which is, makes it hard when you want to stop, because now not only do you want to stop, but you've got to leave the tribe, and you've got to leave the tribe's house.
Absolutely. Is the expectation more from yourself on yourself or the other people on you, do you find? Because I found, really, when I finally threw the towel and stopped, a lot of my friends, well, everyone, a lot of people fell off anyway because they was fair weather friends and it wasn't a real tribe. But the people who really were there, were really happy for me. They're like, thank God you've done that. You know, that's brilliant, because you was getting in trouble over a long period of time. I was told that I should change all my friends. What happened was 80% of them left anyway because they just wanted to continue doing what they're doing, and I didn't. I wanted to go completely opposite way. So I found it like it was a natural progression. And then I found a couple of people saying that they felt like I'd left them, but I was like, I'm saving my life here. I got to a really bad way after using for 18 years.
I think the question you have to ask yourself, Paul, is this. Look at your friends and ask yourself this question. How often do you do something with that particular, just choose one at a time. How often do you do something with that particular friend that does not involve using? How often do you go out with this friend that doesn't involve using cocaine? How often do you go to the pub with this friend that doesn't involve cocaine? How often do you go out to a restaurant with this friend that doesn't use cocaine? How often do you go to the cinema with this friend that doesn't use cocaine? How often do you go to the races with this friend? Or wherever you go, ask yourself that question. And if the answer is 90% of the time that I am with this person that we do anything together involves using, I'm going to tell you that they're your using buddy.
Yeah. Exactly.
They're not your true friend. They're your using buddy. And it is more than likely that once you stop using, you will no longer have that using buddy. Yeah. Now, if they were a true friend that maybe you went to the gym with, that you did went to places with, that maybe you went to a market with on a Sunday or whatever you do, and you did all those things with them that didn't and you didn't use, they're probably going to be your true friend and probably still going to be around. That's how I think you should look at life.
That's exactly what I did. And over that whole period of time, it's literally what I did. And it was quite tough to see, because I was like, actually, you know what? Most of my friends are all to do with drink or drugs or whatever. And we'd bonded in that way. So I thought it was a real friendship. but it's like 3 o'clock in the morning, smoking a joint and being high, and you're talking, you know, you think you like got to a level of Buddha and you're talking about philosophy and stuff and feel like that's a bond. It's not.
Yeah, the kitchen table discussion.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's not a bond.
Plans to take over the world.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But you're right.
And those people are still probably doing that right now.
Yeah. I went to I'd been trying to stop, and I'd seen different people like the one I mentioned, and I'd seen a psychiatrist, and I just put loads of things that I thought would be right to put in place, having no understanding about it. My last night, basically, I'd stopped for 2 weeks, and a friend of mine said, we're going to go to, it was a venue, it was a party for someone whose daughter had passed away, right? It was an annual thing. So I said, well, no one can do anything there anyway, so I'll drive. And he said to me, can you just pick something up for me? And I said, I don't think it's a good idea, mate. I said, let's just, you know, wait. I don't do it anyway. Anyway, the tribe thing. Oh, I'll just go and pick it up for him, okay? And picked it up. Of course, I tested it to make sure it was all right, because I've been doing it for 18 years and, you know, it might not be all right.
Of course.
So by the time I got home, I was ironing my trousers and my jacket. I'd done all of what I picked up apart from a half a gram. So I drive to this venue. At this time, my body was doing some really weird things, right? Like I couldn't talk. I'd get locked jaw. I'd get palpitations. I'd have to slow myself down, the opposite of what it did in the beginning, in case I felt like I was going to have a heart attack. And at this point, I had lots of seizures and stuff. Driving along, and I must have just had a nervous breakdown. I slammed the brakes on the car. Started to smash my face on the steering wheel, punch everything. Literally, it was like I was attacking myself. The phone rang, and I kind of pulled up. I answered the phone, and my friend's like, where are you? The first thing I said was, I've just had a fight with two guys in a pickup truck. I'll be there soon. I couldn't tell the truth. I was so lonely. In that thing about the tribe, you can be so lonely with a group of fellas. Because if they're really your friends, you can talk to them, but not when you're in this tribe, right? And I drove to this venue. Friend came out. He said, where's it all gone? I said, oh, I must have dropped it. Went to the bar, downed a bottle of wine because I needed to get myself together. And I drove a few people back to my place after. And then the guy who was serving up there was a friend of mine. And they all went on into town. And he said, I'll leave you a little bit of coke left, Paul. I went, no, I'm all right, I don't want it. Like, I desperately didn't want it. I said, please don't leave it. He went, no, it's all right, I'll leave it on the side. I went, please don't leave it. He went, no, you drove, you're all right. And done the lot.
You know why he left it for you?
Tell me.
He left it for you because there is something about a person that uses, listen, not just coke, think about someone who smokes. If you've stopped smoking, right, and you go to the, I like to use the pub scenario. If you've stopped smoking, you go to the pub, there will be people around you who say, do you want to come out for a fag? No, I don't smoke anymore. Come, it's Friday, just have one. Yeah, I'll give you one, have one. Hmm. Because somewhere along the line, it makes them feel better. They don't feel so bad about themselves if you still do it as well. So if then you do a line, it's like, oh yeah, I don't feel bad. He's done a line. All right, he couldn't stop anyway. Yeah, I see him do a lot. He couldn't stop. He tried, he couldn't stop. No. Then you don't try again, because then you will remain with them, right? You know, there's a lobster pot. You know how a lobster pot works? They drop it in the sea, right? And there's this little tiny hole, and the lobster climbs in to get the bait. And as it tries to get back out, it's stuck because it's bigger than the hole to go back out the other way, right? Because it narrows. That's like people who use. They pull you into the lobster pot. And once you're in, it's fucking hard to get out because they keep pulling you back. And you know what? Lobsters will pull the legs off other lobsters, and so will crabs, to try and stop them getting out the lobster or the crab pot.
I heard the crab analogy and it made total sense to me. They'll just pull you back in.
Even exactly what they do.
So they all die together. It's exactly that. And years of working and sponsoring people, looking after people in this, it's exactly what I tell them. And it's amazing to be able to have, to go from being completely powerless over that to finding power in yourself after stopping and working.
It's funny, I had a client of mine message me the other day, and I told them a story about when I'd stopped using, and I was with a couple of people who used, and they kept trying to rack up a line. I kept going, no. And they just kept insisting. On the end, I went, all right. And they racked up a line. I walked up to them and I went, just blew off the side. And they looked at me like, because can you imagine to somebody who uses, right, what I've just done? That's like sacrilege. And I just looked at them and I went, told ya. And a client messaged me the other day and said, do you remember that story you told me? He went, I just did that on Friday night. It was so amazing to feel that good.
It's empowering.
Incredibly empowering. Yeah. Incredibly.
Because you become a slave to it. There's a wonderful poem about cocaine. I was telling Shannon, the producer, earlier about it. I'm going to try and find it. How it slowly just takes you over and slowly takes you over. And it's just like being in the back of a cab. It's driving you somewhere. You think you know where you're going, but they're just driving you and driving you and driving you.
You know, if I look back on all the years that I used and all the people that I see and all the stories that I hear, would I have believed them at the very beginning? I don't think so. Hmm. So the question I ask myself is, how do you stop the upcoming people from using, because nobody's going to believe the stories because they're like, that's not me. Had somebody told you when you first started to get into it that this is where you're going to end up, this is what it can do, like 75% of people who use coke and continue on using coke end up with an addiction at some level, right? Yeah. If somebody had told you at that age when you started, would it have changed anything? Would you have believed them?
Someone did. I was like, no chance, not me. You don't know me.
That's I'm exactly
disciplined.
Right.
I'm a sportsman. I'm fit. I'm healthy. I do have an 8-pack, not now, but I do have an 8-pack. You can't touch me.
That's exactly. It's exactly where it is, right? And I have all these comments on my social media, on TikTok and Instagram and YouTube and et cetera, going, yeah, I won't be like that. I'm all right. I just use on the weekend. I don't do more than a Henry, 3.5 or 2 grams. That's all I do. That's all I use. And I always answer with the same thing. Said every addict once.
Yeah. And it's true. I want to ask you what your view on addiction is, but I had this weird epiphany once. I was sitting there thinking, you know, you have these sayings, oh, I was out of my head Friday, I want to get out of my box and all that stuff. I sat there one day and I thought, I used to say that all the time, I'm going to get out of my head, right?
Going to get off me tits.
Why don't I want to get out of my head? I must not like being in it. What's in it that I don't like, that I want to get out of?
Very true.
And I did so much like you earlier. I actually... When I gave up, I had a lot of relationships as well. So when I made a final decision, right, I'm not going to use anymore, it was freeing, but it was very painful because at that point I was in quite a mess, physically and mentally. I basically, for the first year, all I did was read books. Right? I'm dyslexic, so I didn't like reading, but I got 2 dictionaries, American and English, and I went through all the literature about alcoholism and addiction. And I really... I swore I would never drink, and drinking wasn't my thing. But when I looked at it, it was like bacon and eggs in a fry up. I'd always have the both.
It's funny right? You say that, because people ask me this question. Alcohol is not my thing. The person where it killed my dad was drunk. I don't know if that took something inside of my head. I'm not anti-alcohol. Don't misunderstand me. If I go away and I was staying at some beautiful all-inclusive, I don't know, maybe I have like a pina colada. I don't know, maybe I have a glass of wine. I don't know. You know, I have done this. Alcohol was never my problem. Mm. I could drink a glass of wine right now and I wouldn't go and get the packet because I was a dry sniffer. So I think people have to put into context how people use, because if you were a dry sniffer, as long as you drink alcohol in moderation, so let's just put that bit there, because like by the time you get to 5 pints, 8 pints, 10 pints and more, like you're making stupid decisions, right? So let's forget that part. But I'm talking about 1 glass or 2 glasses of wine or 1 pint or 2 pints as a maximum, or 3 pints as a maximum cutoff. If you didn't associate alcohol as a gateway to using, there is no reason why, not necessarily when you stop using, because I always get my patients to stop for, listen, if alcohol was part of the gateway, then of course I'm going to address that and they won't be drinking. But if alcohol was not a gateway and they want to continue on drinking because they want some sort of, I don't know what the word is, but they want to go out and enjoy and they feel that alcohol helps them enjoy themselves if they do it in a small quantity, I don't have a problem with that. I don't have a problem with that at all. I have a problem with someone who used alcohol as a gateway and then continues drinking, but if they didn't, I don't. And I'll give you an example, because people say to me, oh, but you can't drink in moderation, or not me, but people can't drink in moderation. And I always say, that's not true. That's not true. Of course, you can learn to drink in moderation. I think the difference is this. A lot of people drink alcohol because to get out of their head, because they are not comfortable in their own skins. So they want to escape. If you drink because you want to get out of your head, that's a completely different situation. But if you drink because you enjoy the pleasure of it and you only need a small quantity, that's different. Does that make sense?
100%, because it's interesting, because I went to the end of stuff, and a lot of people, I think there's five stages of addiction. Everyone has their own view. I interviewed Professor David Nutt about it, who's incredible neuropharmacologist, and he tells you about the GABA and all the other things. Mm-hmm. But like for me, they usually say in, say, 12-step programs that if you're an addict, you're an addict, and you can get addicted to everything.
They say a lot in the 12-step program.
It's actually, they do, but it's like what you said about hypnosis, right? If you go to the core, right, this has been out since the 30s, and it's actually saved millions and millions of lives. And if you're smart enough to use the tools, like if you're smart enough to go to a gym, not everyone has a six-pack in a gym. In fact, probably a few percentage, right?
Yeah.
If you go and use a gym properly and eat properly and stuff like that, you'll be fit and healthy. And you can use it in that way as well.
If you apply yourself properly.
If you apply yourself properly, it doesn't discriminate from any color, religion, whatever. It's actually really good if you do it properly.
If you apply yourself.
The problem is a lot of people go in because they want to help for their wife or they do stuff and they don't apply it. So it's the same as, I always say it's the same as a gym. And I've been there for 20 years and done hours and hours and hours of stuff and studied it at home, gone through all the programs. Not when you see like meetings on the TV, I thought, well, oh, fuck, that looks nuts. That's just a gathering. It's nothing to do with what it's really about. And actually, it's almost like a long form of CBT. So it's something, if you work, it actually does work. But for me, with the alcohol, I was like, I'm just going to put down everything that affects me. And I loved relationships as well. So I did 1 year not texting, phoning, speaking to a girl, because I thought, like what we said earlier, you got to do it on your own. And I felt like, let me see what happens to me. What if I stop something completely, then I'm going to see what I wanted out of it. And I cried loads of nights from feeling lonely. And then I realized what I was trying to get out of the person, to fill a hole that I felt I had, and loads of stuff over this whole year of doing that. And that was the best thing for me. I wouldn't recommend it to people, but for me...
Where did you learn to get that strength from?
My dad. I'd say. That just come out, but I think my dad. Because there's a lot of times...
So where did you get the strength from to break your addiction?
I personally had at that point, I'd had enough, and it took a couple of people to tell me certain sentences to know that it's possible, that I had done it before.
So in that moment of time, your mind was open to the potential and possibility of changing, and what you had was somebody just turn the key for you.
Literally, yeah.
And then you applied yourself.
Yeah, and then I've heard you talk about driving. I always use the analogy of getting in the car and turning the key and starting. And I literally, I was fortunate enough, still had enough money to not work for 2 years. So I did that. Then I went to an acting school, which was a method called Stanford Meisner.
This is like impromptu, isn't it? I remember we had this discussion. We talked about this.
Yeah, no, Stanford Meisner.
I remember.
It's a Russian
now.
Technique.
Yeah.
And it's about being present in that moment.
That's right.
Right, no matter what's going on. Like the brain will be, oh, I'm nervous or I'm this. It's about being right there, right then. And practicing and learning that at the same time gave me the opportunity to do in different places to learn, because I used to be really rageful from my teen years, to learn to deal with emotions at the same time, deal with situations in a full circumstance that I actually was like, oh, I can use that in real life if this happens. And then I studied a martial art in California. So I went back there, which was an internal martial art of Pakwa Tai Chi, which is the same thing. You see, my master used to make me walk on the other side of the road really slowly, and she'd be asking me questions. What do you see? What do you feel? What do you hear? And I'd listen to my thoughts, to my feelings. There'd be people driving past. You know what it's like. Then no one walks. Hey, asshole, yeah. What are you doing? And I'd get that and not react. So it was like I've retrained myself really over a long period of time and using a 12-step program.
You know... when you talk about the analogy I give of the car and the consciousness, and the reason behind that is this. In 1956, there was a guy called Dr. Miller. He wrote a thesis paper called 7 plus or minus 2, in which he theorized and demonstrated that our conscious mind can be aware of between 5, 7, plus or minus 2, or 9 bits of information at any one time, okay? So you can consciously track between 5 and 9 bits of information at any one time. I'll show you. Think about your feet in your shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Think about your hand touching your other hand.
Mm-hmm.
The whirring of that sound in the background. The temperature of the room. Just think about how your ring feels on your ring finger. And notice slight sensations. And you've probably forgotten about your feet in your shoes. And we got to 6. So what I'm demonstrating is over 9, you can't consciously track. So what happens is you chunk. You chunk piece of information that are lots of singular information into one piece of chunk, like driving now, which was multiple things. Clutch, mirror, indicator, accelerator becomes driving, allowing your conscious mind to only focus on one thing instead of multiple things within it. So what happens is when you learn to use, just going back to addiction, when you learn to use cocaine, all of these things are singular, but become one unit. Does that make sense?
100%.
So at the end of it, your one unit is using, but within that, there are so many small things like driving that need to be addressed to address the one unit.
Totally get it.
That's how I sum it up.
Yeah. It's funny. It would be nice to have met you a long time ago so I could have done that. But actually, to be honest, by doing all this stuff myself and going through the pain of learning and whatnot for me is I never ever want to use again. And I've had situations when we went to Spain, we've got to stop, finish in a minute. When we went to Spain, it's like a test. I was about, I don't know, 6 months sober. And we went to a club with a friend. There was a few of us that were sober just going out. And this girl walked up who was literally from Central Casting. Unbelievable, tall, beautiful, really amazing. Sat up, stepped over me, had no underpants on, opened her handbag. And I swear I thought it was a wind-up. She must have had like 4 or 5 grams. She said she would go and party. And in that moment, it was really interesting. I heard my thought process. I looked at her and I was like, you know what? That's a really kind thing for you to offer, but I'm okay. I walked away. And that for me was like, shit, I've got this. Like I'm all right, actually, you know. Elliot, we're going to have to wrap up in a minute, but I ask everyone this question.
Sure.
It's been lovely to talk to you. I think I could talk to you for hours. If someone's struggling at home with addiction, whether it be alcohol or drugs or someone around them, what's the first move they should do?
Okay, let's just separate this. So firstly, let's talk about a family member having a loved one who has an addiction, because you can try and lead them to water, but you can't make them drink. Mm. And there's no point in, listen, we want to encourage our loved ones. Of course we do, to seek help. But you can't bang your head against a brick wall. In terms of the individual person, you have to get to that point where you made that decision that you really want to do something about it.
Yeah.
And then what are the fundamental things that they should change, that everybody can change themselves without, before they even seek any help, right? I think, first of all, you've got to delete all your numbers. These are common things, right? You've got to delete your numbers. You've got to drop the tribe. Whether alcohol is your gateway or not, I would strongly suggest stopping alcohol for 30 days a month, no matter who you are, because you want to reset your mind. You want to reset everything that's associated with your daily life, right? So stop drinking for a month. People say, yeah, but life's boring now, I don't use. Life's boring. And it is to some extent, and there's a reason why. When you, at the beginning, you did lots of things. You played 5-a-side football, you were out with your mates, you did this, you did that, right? The more you use, the more you narrow down your life of the things that you do. You stop going out, you stop socializing, you stop doing as many things you used to do until eventually, especially if you're a everyday user or a 3 or 4 day user, it becomes you come home, if you even get to work, but you come home from work, let's just assume that, and you start using, you don't do anything else. So when you do stop using, you're kind of at a loss of what to do because you haven't done anything else other than use. It's narrowed down your life so much that life does seem very boring because there's nothing but you and the TV anymore, which is on in the background while you were using. So it's all about understanding that they are building a whole new life and a whole new strategy and a whole new structure and everything about them.
Yeah.
I think that's the question.
Thank you, Elliot Ward.
Paul, pleasure. Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction,
please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also make a donation. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. And if you enjoyed This Is Powerful, please rate, review, and follow the podcast to share it with your friends, your family, anyone you can, and head over to social media. I always love to see and hear how you react to the episodes, and it's so helpful for our content to be shared. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica and Marty, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Henry, you know who you are, and to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. And there's a whole catalogue of episodes wherever you get your podcasts. But did you know you can also watch it on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with Paul Scofield.